WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration is designed to prepare students to lead in the social sector by combining classroom learning with field education and 5 focused pathways. The final deadline for the program is April 1st. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork.
Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Stick around to get updates on the latest stories happening right here in Chicago. But first, with public health, what happens across the globe can land right in your backyard. Last month, the U.S. withdrew from the World Health Organization, criticizing its handling of the COVID pandemic. But states like Illinois are not stepping away. We actually just joined the WHO's Global Outbreak Alert and Response Network to continue tracking emerging health threats. Now, how does this move keep Illinoisans safer? We'll dig in with a panel of health experts. At the table was Ameya Pawar, president and CEO of Michael Reese Health Trust, Dr. Emily Landon, infectious disease specialist at UChicago Medicine, and Dr. Samir Vohra, director of the Illinois Department of Public Health, joined us remotely from Springfield. I started by going around the room and asking for their initial reactions to the fact that the United States left the World Health Organization. Dr. Landon went first.
I think we're shooting ourselves in the foot. I think this is a penalty for something that I mean, maybe you can criticize some of what the WHO did to respond to COVID, but I don't think that pulling its funding and stopping work on all global health is the right response.
Dr. Vohra?
We first understood that this was happening about a year ago with the president's executive order. It was really critical, and under Governor Pritzker's leadership, that we were making the types of preparations to understand what those global challenges were and different ways that we could make sure to protect the health of Illinois residents. And that's been a progressive path to get more expertise, have those meetings, and just this week being able to join WHO's Global Outbreak Alert and Response Network.
Ameya?
You know, it's disconcerting. It's scary to think that the federal government is retreating from institutions where collective action is important, where responding to disease and pandemics, these things don't know borders, and yet, you know, the federal government is retreating. So to see the state of Illinois step up and leaders step up and step into the breach is inspiring. And, you know, it's not going to solve everything, but it is an important step and hopefully a signal to other states that, you know, perhaps a new version of federalism is required at the moment.
Yeah, and we'll touch more on that in a moment. But Dr. Vohra, I mean, I gave a little bit of a teaser there, but can you just dig in for us? I mean, why did the U.S. leave the WHO in the first place? What was the reasoning that we got?
Well, the reasoning from the federal government was partly, as Dr. Langdon said, their critiques around how the WHO performed during the COVID-19 pandemic, and criticisms that there wasn't the type of response and leadership that was needed. I think from our vantage point, though, is that we as the United States have built the foundation of the global health infrastructure. And as Ameya Pawar mentioned, the ability for us to have collective action and work with the partners in the WHO to make the global health community better. That's what makes our residents in the United States healthier and better too. And we're taking small steps to be able to make sure that our Illinois residents can be healthier through those partnerships that we can make with the WHO and other global health leaders and institutes across Illinois and across the state and across the world.
Mm-hmm. You said earlier, Dr. Landon, we're shooting ourselves in the foot. I mean, do you think that there is any validity at all to the federal government's reasoning here?
Well, I think when it comes to something as important as people's health, we need to work together. I mean, this is like upsetting the game board and walking away, which may be an effective tactic in some business negotiations or some contracts. I have no idea. I don't do that sort of thing. But when it comes to trying to protect the health of the entire globe, and that's really important here, right? Mm-hmm. If we're able to stop diseases or control diseases, contain diseases, especially communicable ones, at their origin, when these small outbreaks happen, that really protects us. And it saves us money, and it saves us time, and it saves us effort, and allows us to continue to invest in health on a local scale. But if we just upset the game board and walk away, we don't have that anymore. And so this is not the sort of partnership where when there's a criticism about how something was handled, that the right thing to do is to ignore it and walk away. This is the time when it's best to do diplomacy and to work together and try and right those wrongs for the future.
What do you think, Amaya? I mean, can you find any validity in the criticism of how the pandemic was handled?
I mean, we have experts that were learning things in real time. That's what you do. My background's in emergency management. By the way, we're also retreating by defunding FEMA and other critical emergency preparedness mechanisms. So it's not just in public health. This is just a withering away of our general posture to being prepared for different kinds of crises. Yeah. I think we have prioritized hyper-individualism and likes and subscribe over expertise and competence. Mm. And that, to me, is a very scary situation.
So, Dr. Varro, what is this Global Outbreak Alert and Response Network, and how exactly does it work?
So what it is the World Health Organization coordinates a worldwide partnership of hundreds of public health institutions, national governments, academic centers, laboratories, and response organizations focused on rapidly detecting and responding to emerging public health threats. And so our membership, what it allows us is that it strengthens our preparedness for future pandemics and emerging threats, while also complementing the ongoing coordination with our U.S. public health partners. We will get direct access to global outbreak intelligence, opportunities for collaboration and surge support during major public health events, mm-hmm. participating in training and exercises, and then stronger coordination between state-level public health systems and global response efforts.
And so talk to me on this level, Dr. Landon. I mean, what kind of information do you think we'll have access to through this network? And maybe you can share some examples.
Yeah, there's no substitute for participating in these networks and working with other people and just making, you know, friends and having access to the email chains and the WhatsApp groups, mm-hmm. and all of the confirmation and information that's transferred, the education, learning from one another. It's definitely
going to share information throughout the state, right?
This is going to really elevate public health in Illinois. And I think that's going to be amazing because we've already seen an erosion of what we can rely on from the CDC because of the way that the administration has kind of defunded or deprioritized public health or collective public health on the part of the whole country. And so I think anything we can do to gain more expertise and to get more connections globally is going to be helpful for us, and it's going to be huge. But I also think that there's still a limit as to what we can do if only part of the United States are willing to participate. Because when and if the next pandemic or large scale, you know, high consequence pathogen comes to the United States, it's not just going to be Illinois.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because we know that joining this Global Outbreak Alert and Response Network It's great. It's not quite the same, though, as the entire country being part of the WHO as it had been. So I do want to hear from you, Amaya, and you, Dr. Vora. What gaps do you think are still going to remain here?
I mean, again, I think one state participating, California being the other, is not going to solve everything. But if you think about what Illinois represents in terms of a GDP, it is on scale with other large nations. And so when Illinois, with its continued leadership, it is not just as an aside, you know, we are a haven for reproductive health and rights, but we're also now the safety net for the nation. If we lead on public health, it's also a demonstration to other leaders that public health surveillance, cooperation, collective action matters.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Vora, what gaps do you think in protection would still remain, even though we're now a part of this network?
Well, I think simply there's only so much one state can do when these types of programs, initiatives require national response. And something as big as global health, of course, the United States also put up a large degree of funding for the WHO. And as I mentioned previously, really built the foundation of the global health community. When we step away with our funding, with our expertise, that leads to issues where other states and other countries may be more reticent to stand up and lead. And I think very fortunate for us, under the leadership of Governor Pritzker, around public health, around evidence-informed things, around many issues, we have, as Amaya said, stepped up to mitigate when the federal government has stepped aside. And I think it's been a really critical place for us to lead with purpose, lead with our honor, and then lead with conviction to ensure that we're doing what's best for our residents and ultimately sets an example for other states to follow.
And Dr. Landon, so we know what it looks like when things were flowing correctly. You're working here as a local infectious disease specialist, right? How does information coming from the WHO impact your work?
It's huge. I mean, every day I'm staying on top of what's happening across the globe because I need to be prepared to protect my patients at our hospital from any threats that may come our way. And having access to those channels of communication, not just what people see in the news, but the back channels of communication from my colleagues in Chicago Department of Public Health and Dr. Vora and the Illinois Department of Public Health, having those sort of discrete and sort of really important background information about what's really going on the ground helps us to figure out how much we need to invest in that and how much of a risk and a threat that's going to be to people in Chicago and people that come to my hospital.
Yeah. So the White House isn't only criticizing the WHO, right, but also Illinois' efforts. So here's what a statement from a spokesperson from the White House reads in part. It says, quote, "The World Health Organization knowingly and deliberately lied about COVID-19 at the outset of the pandemic and is a key reason why many countries were caught off guard. Illinois state officials' insistence on maintaining access to WHO resources and information despite this gross travesty is more proof that Illinois suffers from incompetent leadership." Dr. Vora, your response.
Well, I would say that that's completely untrue. Part of our goal here is really to get access to important, critical information that allows us to make the best decisions with the best available evidence and science to help our residents. We've seen this has been a commitment for us across public health. When we talk about vaccine policy, when we talk about vaccine guidance throughout a childhood immunizational schedule for things like disease prevention in general, but now here on emerging public health threats. And that information allows us, with experts like Dr. Langdon, Amaya, many of the individuals that we work with across the state, to then provide the most up-to-date guidance to our residents. Mm-hmm. Ensuring that we have access to this information is good for everybody. Blocking that access doesn't allow us to take the full weight of evidence to be able to drive science-based and evidence-based decisions to protect our public.
You know, Amaya, Dr. Vora brings up, you know, something interesting. I was thinking about the fact that this is not the first time we've seen Illinois sort of move in its own direction and have to create its own guidelines just within this last 12 months, right, mm-hmm. of this new administration. I'm thinking of vaccines, of course. That was a huge one. So talk about what it means to you when the state needs to be put in a position to take a step like this, a giant step like this, and then whether there are drawbacks from separating Illinois from the federal guidance.
I don't think there are any drawbacks. In fact, I think it's a benefit to Illinoisans, but also Americans, because it is, again, demonstrating leadership.
Perhaps others could follow suit.
Again, others can follow suit. And I also just want to give a personal example. So my dad grew up in India, very poor, and he battled typhoid, tuberculosis, and hunger. That stunted his growth. He's 5'2". I'm 6 feet tall because I had access to public health and medicine here in Illinois. Literally the physical manifestation of access to care and public health and clean water. These things don't just happen by chance. It happens with leadership, and that's what Governor Pritzker and the state are demonstrating.
Your thoughts, Dr. Landon?
I think that when it comes to especially communicable diseases, we don't have the luxury of letting everybody do their own thing and sort of, I mean, you can still make your own choices about how you want to live your life. But when it comes to public health, we need to work together.
But does moves like what the federal government has done, does that create a burden, you think, for state leaders to make the right decisions for the health and safety of all the people who live here in Illinois?
We all have access to the same data and the same information when we work together. And asking states to separately pay for and run, like sort of reinvent the wheel for their state when it comes to things where the data is not super different about, you know, measles vaccination, for example, or, you know, influenza maybe is a better example of something that should be done on a more state and more local level. But there are a lot of things that we are better off dealing with and making plans for all together and sharing our data and working together. And when we have to divert our, you know, local Illinois resources towards having a Nipah virus specialist in order to evaluate the risk of whether or not the current Nipah virus outbreak in India is going to pose a threat to Illinois, that's a waste for every state to have to do that on their own.
Yeah.
And I think that it's better when we work together. And there are some things that should be done by states and local public health departments. And the arrangement that we have, while not perfect, was functional and provided us with enough to improve public health over decades. And we're walking that back just doesn't seem, instead of, you know, attempting to change it or improve it, doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
How else is Michael Reese working towards protecting public health today?
I mean, we are in the midst of finding ways to support our grantees, many of whom are on the front line trying to make sense of how do we address hunger in the coming months with SNAP requirements changing? How do we think about Medicaid enrollment as the federal government narrows access to healthcare? This, again, there's a pattern in practice happening here. Mm-hmm. We're narrowing access to the safety net. We're withering away emergency management systems. We're destroying public health infrastructure. And there is nothing about all of this that helps people. And so philanthropy's role right now is really to step into the breach, but again, remind people that we can't solve everything. Government needs to do its job at the federal level, and we're hoping to continue to demonstrate that.
So, Dr. Vora, just leave us with this. I mean, it's clear that now it's important more than ever to stay connected to the global community when it comes to public health. But what more do you think needs to be done?
I think, as we've sort of talked about here, public health is fueled by the power of partnership, but it's also a commitment to scientific processes, the full weight of scientific evidence that allows us to make the types of recommendations that make us all healthy. We are public health is often an expression that we talk about in terms of community. And we have an incredible local community in our cities, in our state. But public health really needs a global community to partner. And we're thrilled to partner with our states, really the federal government, when they'll stick to those principles. But when they don't, I'm very fortunate to be here as the state health official in Illinois under the governor, Governor Pritzker's leadership. Well, we'll do and we'll step in to do the right thing to make sure that our residents are healthy and safe.
Dr. Samir Vora is director of the Illinois Department of Public Health. Ameya Pawar is president and CEO of Michael Reese Health Trust. And Dr. Emily Landon is with UChicago Medicine. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Now it's time to get into the top local stories of the day. At the table to help me break them down, Mary Norkel, Chicago Sun-Times reporter, Adriana Cardona-Magiget, WBEZ's immigration reporter, and as always, Claire Lane, WBEZ's Morning Edition anchor. This week, Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem announced a new requirement for federal immigration agents, and Claire got us up to speed.
Homeland Security says that they will require all of the department's officers on the ground, this is anywhere, especially in Minneapolis, most recently with current events, to wear body cameras. So Kristi Noem made the announcement on X, kind of casual. Minneapolis, as we know, has been the site of lots of intensities, but intense scrutiny over the conduct of immigration enforcement agents. And there have been increased calls by critics of Homeland Security, critics of Noem, to require all of the department's officers who are responsible for any immigration enforcement to wear these body cameras. But obviously, us in Chicago as well have been calling for this after Operation Midway Blitz.
What's the latest that we've been hearing from President Trump?
President Trump said the decision was up to Noem, but added that he thought it was, quote, generally good for law enforcement to wear cameras.
So do we think that this is going to be the case if and when these ICE agents come back to Chicago in the spring?
Presumably, yes. But, you know, we should note that this is also a requirement of CPD officers, and there can be some issues with that.
Mm-hmm.
Are you wearing them? Yes. Are they turned on?
Yeah. Right. That is the other question. So I imagine, Mary, that this news of wearing body cams would be welcome to these two Chicago teens that you were following. They've made it their mission to document immigration officers over the last little bit, and you caught up with them. Tell us more.
Yes. So I talked to 16 and 17-year-old brothers, Ben and Sam Lumen. They're from West Chicago. They were actually born in Minneapolis and moved here after some of their childhood, but now they have been following ICE agents, have been recording them and uploading their footage of, conduct and protests and any arrests that they might see to a Google Drive folder that they want to make available to everyone. And yeah, I would imagine that that's welcome news to them, but I also would imagine that they have the same questions that we do about enforcement of this rule.
Yeah, and talk more about how they compare what they saw as far as federal agent operations here in Chicago and what happened in Minneapolis.
There was no question to them that Minneapolis was a huge step up in these immigration operations and this deportation campaign. They were doing the same work in the Chicago suburbs. And then earlier this month decided to head up to Minneapolis when the Trump administration's focus shifted. And they said, we've seen both. And Minneapolis is not only so much more of a step up in the amount of officers that they're seeing, amount of ICE agents, CBP, but also, just more aggression, more tension with protesters, and also a much more organized network of community activists as well, is what they said.
I feel like it's just going to keep going up, Mary. Mm-hmm. Something tells me that if they come back here in the spring, it's just going to be on a
a level that we yes. might have not seen yet.
Yes, we talked about that as well. And they definitely said, you know, we've learned a lot from these activists in Minneapolis, many of whom really, you know, stepped up during the protests after the George Floyd murder in 2020. Mm-hmm. And so there's a very robust system there, and they're going to take some tips back here. Especially if ICE comes back here in full force.
Yeah. And what's really interesting about these young men, we should really call them that because mm-hmm. they're so well-spoken and they're so brave. The audio is on WBEZ.org of this as well. But that they remain optimistic mm-hmm. after coming home covered in pepper spray. You know, they were at the scene after Alex Preddy's death.
Wow.
You know, yeah. they remain optimistic in humanity that there's going to be triumph, that together, you know, people will be able to get through this. And it's really, their story is really empowering.
Yes. And to that point, you know, I asked them, how do you think your age is playing into your perspective on this and being so much younger?
Yeah, good question.
And they kind of were not too concerned with it, but I asked their parents the same thing. And they said, you know, they have this outlook that they can still do things. They have this kind of youthful optimism, to your point, Claire. So it's, you know, we'll see. I think, you know, they have inspired other young people to get involved. You know,
that whether generation is just relentless.
Totally. You know? Totally. Yeah. Whether it's actually following ICE agents around or not, we'll see. But yeah, they definitely have learned a lot and they've seen so much, you know, being on the scene after Preddy was killed and, you know, really up close and personal with mm-hmm. agents like Greg Bovino, who we've been talking about for months now. Wow. They are right in the thick of it.
2026 is off to an interesting start. Yeah, and Adriana, you sat down with a victim of this aggressive enforcement tactic, Miramar Martinez, right? She's that Chicago woman who was shot by Border Patrol 5 times. She's speaking out publicly. Tell me your biggest takeaways from that sit down.
My gosh. So we interviewed her on Sunday, me and my colleague, John Seidel. And I mean, she's been painted as this domestic terrorist by the Department of Homeland Security. And we were able to really see her personality kind of like come through and share her story. Mm-hmm. She comes from a large Mexican immigrant family, mixed status. So with some people are, you know, they have papers, some of them don't. Mm-hmm. And you know, she's been, her family and friends have been affected by the enforcement operations. So she decides to go out one day to, you know, donate just like on a regular Saturday, you know, like many of us were like getting rid of our, you know, stuff. And
yes,
she spotted, you know, these agents in the area where she was on the southwest side. She gets triggered because she's like, enough is enough. Like, too many people have been affected by this. And she decides to follow them and warn others of their presence. So she gets out her phone. Like, we know that story, right? She starts yelling. Mm-hmm.
Videotaping.
And she feels so empowered, she says. She says at some point she prevented some landscapers from getting arrested. And people that she saw outside after she was warning people, they just ran inside. And she was really empowered by this. But at some point she's like, okay, I got to move on with my day. I'm meeting my boyfriend. And things also were kind of like getting a little bit just too much for her. Right. Like she's like, okay, things are getting a little dangerous here, so I'm going to, you know, leave. And that's when, as she was trying to leave, she describes the moments of the shooting. And, you know, we have a lot of those details online and in the story that yes. aired yesterday. So I encourage everyone to go check that out.
She also testified in a public forum in D.C. Yeah. Yesterday. Tell us a bit more about what she said. I guess she probably recounted that story. But what was her message?
Yeah, she pretty much said, like, I am, you know, I am here. I survived the 5 shots, and I am here to use that opportunity, the opportunity that Renee Good and Alex Preti and Silverio, you know, Villegas Gonzalez mm-hmm. didn't have. I am them, and I'm here to share my story. My name needs to be clear. Like, all charges against her have been dropped.
Yeah. Let's hear a little bit from her.
On Friday, I was teaching the young children at the Montessori school, and we were singing and dancing and getting ready for spooky season, preparing fall activities to do the following week. And on Saturday, my own government was calling me a domestic terrorist, and I was in federal detention centers with the bullet holes all over my body.
Yeah, and as you said, all charges have been dropped, right?
Yeah.
So essentially the saga for her is over.
Yeah, and but what's interesting about this is that the Department of Homeland Security has issued statements recently saying that they stand by their press releases and statements. And so she really just wants to also clear her name.
So they're still calling her a domestic terrorist, even though the charges are dropped. Wow. And relatedly, you followed the story of a Chicago couple who was separated by this Operation Midway Blitz. What should we know from that?
Yeah, so I've been following this couple. They got married last fall, and 8 days later, they were actually in a local flea market, Azuaparama, in back of the yards on the southwest side, and that's when they got arrested. And again, that was like just 8 days after they like tied the knot. And at some point, they were telling me, like, gosh, we pretty much spent our honeymoon at the Broadview facility. And ever since, it's just been a saga. Like, he was sent to detention. She was deported eventually. And they've been trying to reunite. He's also on the list of people who were, you know, who were arrested in violation of the settlement agreement that restricts agents from arresting people without warrants or probable cause. So he's on that list, and he's been waiting to see if there's any resolution on that case. But, you know, there hasn't really been much. So,
Wow. Let's pivot here, Mary. This is also another sad story, but this is a little bit different. This is about a TikTok trend that went very wrong in Plainfield. What happened?
Yeah. It seems like every couple of years there's a TikTok trend or social media trend that gets people in trouble. So 9-year-old Caleb Grubb ended up in the hospital after he put a toy. It's called a Nido Cube. It's basically just a plastic or rubber cube filled with like this gel material.
Okay.
And he put it in the microwave because of a TikTok trend that he heard about from a friend at school, and opened the microwave and the thing exploded over his hands and his body and his face.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So he's recovering, but he is, you know, Loyola Medicine is warning people about this trend because that's their fourth injury of the year tied to this trend. So everybody be careful. Don't be putting your toys in the microwave.
Yeah, and parents, watch out for that one.
Yeah.
Too. Make sure your kid does not have one of these Nido cubes.
Right.
And certainly that they're not paying attention to TikTok videos about putting it in the microwave.
In the microwave, yes. Yeah. Yes. Oh, so, yeah, he's on the mend, but look out for that one.
What other headlines are you following today, Claire?
Well, we've got some music news, if anyone's feeling groovy, for May. This is going to be May 23rd and 24th. It's called the Warm Love, Cool Dreams Music Festival. Very enticing.
Ooh, got a lot of music festivals that weekend.
Yeah, it's a popular weekend. This one's going to be at the Salt Shed featuring Courtney Barnett, Tortoise, Toro Amoy, and others.
Oh, nice. All right, so place your bets. Brookfield Zoo predicted this Sunday's Super Bowl winner. Apparently, there's a tarantula named Charlotte predicting that the Seattle Seahawks.
All right. Well,
are going
I can
to
get
be
on board
winners.
With that. I can get on board with Charlotte.
A lion named Zarina at a zoo in Des Moines, Iowa, also predicted that the Seahawks are going to win. So animals there, they actually have correctly predicted the winner 80% of the time. So.
Wow.
So maybe Zarina, the lion, is onto something. And we also checked Guacamole, who's a rescued sea turtle in San Antonio, also chose the Seahawks to win. So no love for the Patriots, apparently, from these animals.
Yeah, I think people are past the Patriots. And animals are past the Patriots, apparently.
Are either of you gearing up for the Super Bowl this weekend?
You know,
I know your team's out.
You know, my beloved Packers got knocked out
a long time ago
in a heartbreaking loss.
Gosh, who took them out?
I don't remember.
And please do not hate me, America. I do not follow America.
Oh, Adriana, we're so disappointed.
You know, go to a Super Bowl party.
But
get
I'm a Lions
food.
Fan. I'm a Lions
okay,
fan.
Okay, fair. As long as it's not the Bears.
Yeah, and I'm going to go with these animals, and I'm going to say it's the Seahawks.
I think so, too. 80%, you have to go with them, right?
I've got to go with Charlotte, Zarina, and Guacamole.
Right. I've seen people doing that with their dogs. I guess it's just one step up to do it with the tarantulas and the lions.
One of these traditions that the zoos are doing to get in on the fun, which can't be mad at that.
Right? All right, fair enough.
Mary Norkel from the Chicago Sun-Times, Adriana Cardona-Magigad, and Claire Lane from WBEZ.
This episode of In the Loop was produced by me, Micah Yasin, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/in the loop. Thanks for listening.